Hello again, welcome back to Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. I'm Stephen Downs, and I'm knee-deep in Module 6, the Duty of Care. In this particular part of the presentation, we'll be looking at the idea of care as a virtue. Now, of course, we explored the idea of virtue ethics back in Module 5, and here we're sort of looking at the idea of a point where, as Howard Kurzer says, three of the most fashionable recent movements in ethics, virtue ethics, medical ethics, and feminist ethics, intersect. I note that he's writing in 1993, before either the Gilligan's book or the Noddings book were published, and so that speaks to a movement that was already existing before these contributions came into play, although, of course, there are earlier discussions and papers by both of them. Nonetheless, it points to the fact that there's this overall movement here, and we don't have the great author theory of ethics philosophy happening here. But that's an aside. Kurzer takes a look at this, his response is kind of what we might imagine, although as a philosopher, he's going to give us three theses. Thesis A, which is the idea of care as emotional attachment, such as liking or loving or, being in a relationship with, in the sense we normally think of it as being in a relationship with someone. As compared to thesis B2, benevolence as a role virtue for healthcare practitioners, which is the context in which this discussion takes place. And B2, did I say B2 the first time? I meant B1. B2, benevolence disposes healthcare practitioners to perform caring acts. So we have two kinds of care here being discussed. Care as emotional attachment and care as benevolence. One of them creates the attachment. I just finished doing the video on relationships, and we get a sense of what we mean by that from that video. But the other sense disposes healthcare practitioners to perform caring acts. This kind of abstracts out the particular emotional content of caring, the part that I would say arguably creates the urgency or the motivation that actually creates a duty to act according to care ethics, abstracts that away and gives us what essentially is a behaviorist analysis. The word disposes is a clue to that, because in behaviorist theory, the idea is that mental states can be described as or reduced to dispositions to act in such and such a way. Gilbert Ryle, for example, in The Concept of Mind, is very explicit about the characterization of mental states as dispositions. That can take us down a whole side inquiry, because dispositions, properly so called, are counterfactuals, except in the very specific case where the disposition is instantiated as an actual act. But then it wouldn't be a mental state, it would be pure behavior. Excuse me, my voice is getting raw from all of these videos. Anyhow, Kurzer, not surprisingly, favors the combination of B1 and B2 as opposed to A, and he says, indeed, emotional attachment is incidental and destructive to the practice of healthcare, and indeed that the healthcare professional should be objective, quote unquote. Now, we've talked about objectivity already in previous videos, and the difficulties with that concept, especially with respect to ethics and ethics of care, and I think those discussions apply here as well. But it does raise the idea of caring as a virtue, as opposed to, say, caring as the description of an act, or caring as even the description of a relationship. You know, if we think of caring or the capacity to care as the property of the carer rather than an analysis of the interaction, there's the suggestion here that we might learn more about it. So, you know, Kurzer's conclusion notwithstanding, I think he's on to something here, at least as something worth exploring. And it does come up in the ethics of care literature. Again, you know, it's the sort of thing you kind of have to interpret that it's there, but coming from the background that I've just sketched in the previous modules, we're sort of, you know, have half an eye open for it anyways, just in case. And so, you know, you can see it in that way, and we'll talk about that in this video. So, let's begin. We'll jump from the healthcare perspective to the teaching perspective, although all of this could be applied to healthcare, and it could all be applied to any of the caring professions. And that's the idea of the teacher as an authority, or, you know, the person providing the care as an authority. And it is by virtue of the properties, their own properties, that they acquire this capacity. And we can look at the list of productive leadership in the classroom from Savage and Savage for, you know, just a model to use. It doesn't matter exactly how we cash this out. But, you know, this is typical, right? The authority of a teacher is based on legitimacy. They're in a position or a role. They're based on the teacher's capacity to give rewards, such as grades and certificates. In some instances, they acquire authority from their ability to punish. This is especially the case with teachers and children. More to the point, though, the authority aspect as teacher qua teacher comes from being an expert, having superior knowledge. I get that sometimes where people defer to what I say just because the presumption is I have superior knowledge. I know more about the subject than they do, so they want to listen to me and will defer to what I say. And then finally, perceived as caring also confers authority with the best interests of students in mind. So that's the professionalism aspect. Now, all of these could be thought of as attributes of the teacher, right? All of these put together could give us this picture of the teacher as authority figure, such that caring is one of these properties of an authority figure, as is presented here by Savage and Savage. And just as an aside, I may be grossly mischaracterizing Savage and Savage. I don't care. I do care, but you know what I mean. I'm using them as a tool. I'm using this diagram as a tool only, and not going for an accurate representation of what they actually say. So if it is a misrepresentation, I'm sorry. But you get the idea, right? They say developing productive leadership in the classroom is based on the establishment of expert and reference authority. It's the bottom two, right? Which is properties of the teacher, right? Being knowledgeable and caring about the development of the student. Noddings talks about this kind of role as well. Teachers feel a duty to know and to use our knowledge to initiate the young into a community of knowing, right? So our knowledge is a virtue that we have that helps motivate this duty. In fact, we wouldn't have a duty to teach, would we? If we didn't already possess the virtue of having knowledge worth teaching, which puts me in a tough situation, but that's a jest. So how do we characterize what that virtue is that a teacher should have? Well, that's where we run into problems. Noddings continues. The world is now so enormously complex that we cannot reasonably describe one model of an educated person. Carers dedicated to their own view of what the cared for should be and do lack integrity. And this is an important concept here. I'm sort of turning it on its head, okay? Noddings is talking about the illegitimacy of a person using their authority to impose some sort of idea of what a person should be and what a person should do onto their students. And that in itself is a radical notion. But turning that around, it would be equally irresponsible for us as ethicists to impose our point of view on what teachers should be and teachers should do. You see the move that I'm making here. So right off the bat, there's a bit of a question of the legitimacy of talking about the virtue of a teacher or the virtue of a medical professional, etc., from in our terms. And we need to be careful about that. It doesn't mean we can't talk about it, though. It just means, I think, that different virtues will be relevant in different contexts, and what will constitute the virtue of a teacher or the virtue of a medical professional will vary from circumstance to circumstance. And so, if we're talking to a teacher, say, about their ethical status with respect to, say, their knowledge or their capacity to care, our discussion has to be between us, based on a relationship between us where we've actually talked about it for a bit and based in actual concrete circumstances. But we can still talk about it, and so we shall. One aspect of the virtue of a carer is empathy. And we've touched on that above already, and we're going to talk about it now a bit more precisely. Because as Noddings notes, some writers interested in care ethics put great emphasis on empathy. Quoting Hoffman, for example, empathy is the cognitive awareness of another person's internal states, that is, his thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and intentions. And, very importantly, the vicarious affective response to another person. So you see the two aspects here. Excuse me. One is, we might say, I know how you're feeling. The other aspect is, and I feel it too. Right? You need both aspects. Mostly when people talk about empathy, they talk about the second, the actual feeling that someone has. And I think most of us get that from time to time. We talked in another discussion about the effect of mirror neurons, and how one person's affective state can be mirrored in someone else's. I talked about being a fan of fail videos, and when somebody crashes their bicycle, say, and they go through a painful event, I have a vicarious reaction. I go, oh no. very much in sympathy with the person who's just crashed their bicycle. So that's the part that we talk about. But the other part, actually getting the cognitive awareness, that's kind of a skill, perhaps. It's a bit much to say that we can know what the other person's thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and intentions are, but we certainly make inferences to them. And some people, I think, depict empathy as being able to do this with some degree of accuracy. I don't know if there's a natural capacity to be more or less good at doing that. We could conduct psychological experiments, but then we're bogged down into what do we mean by thoughts? What do we mean by feelings, perceptions, intentions, etc.? How would I know that I have correctly interpreted the intention of another person if I don't know what an intention is? Okay, so we get into a discussion, well, what is an intention? I'm not sure I know what an intention is. I can make a prediction about what I think a person is going to do, and in fact, my success in driving in traffic depends on that. But that's not the same as making a mental leap and ascribing to them a particular mental state. It's just a prediction about, yeah, they're going to turn left. We need to be careful about what we mean when we talk about empathy. In the end, I'm going to talk about sensations and I'm going to talk about sentiments, and in and among these sentiments is probably something like the capacity to predict what's going to happen. But whether that's a virtue, properly so called, as distinct from simply a capacity to predict what's going to happen, I think is, it's almost an irrelevant question. Anyhow, the idea in ethics of care theory is that empathy may be related to the motivational effect of care. And Kurzer actually does recognize that this is the case, that there is an impact, that relationships will have an impact on motivation. But the perception here is that this should be more of an objective disposition to care for the other person as opposed to an emotional need to care for another person. But the question here then becomes, can you create a duty out of a disposition? Or do you actually need a motivation, right? And this is where we come back to Hume, who would say, it is the passions, that is, the motivations and inclinations to act, that rule here. Even if we had a disposition to act, that does not in itself rise to the level of ethics, because that would give us things like ethical machines simply on the basis of the observation that a machine counterfactually will act in a certain way when presented with certain circumstances. For example, a sentiment detection algorithm might respond with the message, "There, there," right? And it seems like care, right? But really, it's just a disposition. Detect the sentiment, go care, care, or there, there. That doesn't really seem to be actual care, and it doesn't really seem to be an ethical response, or more to the point, an ethic, a response based in ethics. And the other side of it is empathy by itself isn't enough to generate the caring response. Empathy isn't a substitute for expressed response. Just because you feel something, just because it makes you go ew or whatever, isn't enough. The response for, and here I'm quoting nodding, so the response for, or sorry, the response of the cared for completes the caring relation. So it's what they say back after you've done it. Without it, there is no caring relation, no matter how hard the carer has tried to care. So saying there doesn't mean that you care. It actually has to have an impact on the person you've said there to, and it's this interplay back and forth, and that's where the disposition fails, right? Simply a disposition isn't enough to create this ethical aspect of caring. Now I mentioned earlier, I'll talk about empathy as a sensation. And I think this is an important thing, though. Now, a sensation isn't all by itself a motivation to act. And certainly a sensation isn't all by itself an example of caring. But it is the starting point, right? It's the idea of empathy as the thing that makes us actually do something. Simply having the empathy isn't enough. That's what the cartoon says, right? I appreciate all your empathy, but what I really need is some money. So now we have the expressed need. And if you aren't motivated to respond to that expressed need, here we have the rich person not really willing to respond to the expressed need of the hobo, then you have what might be called kind of an empty empathy, right? You feel for the person, but not so much that it generates an ethical obligation on your own part. But anyhow, it does, you know, we do have, you know, a lot of ways of looking at you know, our relationship with other people, both in person and online, and our relationship with other beings, whether they be machines, animals, whatever, as a study of our own response. I also mentioned in this slide cognitive versus emotional empathy by Jody Clark, and I think we can cash that out to some degree as knowing what the mental state is as opposed to feeling or responding to the mental state. Or maybe I shouldn't say mental state. I mean, this whole concept of empathy implies, you know, this architecture of mental states in the other person, and we are going to access them and then maybe draw them out and name them. Feelings of oppression, feelings of hopelessness, feelings of pain, whatever. But our categorizations here are probably hopelessly wrong, or more to the point, hopelessly empty, in that, you know, the word, say, pain may or may not refer to a distinct set of neural states. And the, you know, the concept of pain actually may represent a cognitive and linguistic construct on our part and on the part of society, and not correspond to anything that the other person actually has or is feeling. So, again, we come back to the question, is all of this stuff, this capacity to do all of that, a virtue? You know, I think we can talk about maybe there being a virtue in having a sensation, which we call empathy, which we depict as feeling the same thing that they're feeling, which motivates to us to act. That might be a virtue. Certainly it seems to be a property or a capacity of a person. And if it has ethical importance, then we could say that it's a virtue. But we want to be careful here, right? We don't want to read too much into this. We don't want to make virtues out of things that where there may not actually be any virtue attached, such as the characterization of a certain set of responses and our feelings about that as an attribution of quote-unquote pain. I know that that's horribly complex, and I don't want it to be complex like that, but, you know, when we start talking about personal capacities as virtues, you know, it's kind of important to talk about what you really mean by that. What is it about that capacity that makes it a virtue, versus what aspects of that capacity are purely incidental and just the way we happen to do it now. Nonetheless, Noddings and others talk about the capacities of people to care. Noddings says explicitly, people have various capacities for caring, that is, for entering into caring relations as well as for attending to objects and ideas. And that's where we come back to the discussion of factors that impinge on or our barriers to our ability or our capacity to care. The wide range of social and environmental and relationship factors that come into this. For example, and here's a few, right? The social construction of caring as feminine and thus less worthwhile. The churn of clients, which creates an inability to actually develop a relationship with any of them. Associated responsibilities caused by digital technology or digital red tape. And then work-related stress that can create implicit biases, etc. All of these impact on the actual capacity we have to be caring and to give care. And I think both of those things, being caring and giving care, both of those are affected. I don't think of them as the same thing. And so kind of implicitly, we're talking about caring as a capacity, which we can have to more or less a degree, and as a capacity in an ethics of care, then presumably that capacity is a virtue. But again, I think we want to be careful about what aspect of that is the actual virtue. Because, you know, we don't want to say, for example, that, you know, if a person is, you know, if that capacity is treated as less worthwhile by society, it doesn't, and because of that, the ability to express that capacity is diminished. We don't want to say that as a result, the person in question is less virtuous. And that's a really important concept, right? When we do virtue ethics, we're talking about the nature of the person themselves. As developed through experience, training, personal development, working on myself, etc. We rarely talk about the external conditions that impact that virtue. And so we might think of a person who is wise and moderate and temperate, etc., as being more virtuous. But here, I think we need to say, and we need to be clear about this, that if a person is raised in conditions that act against those capacities being developed in them, they're less moderate, less temperate, etc., that doesn't by itself make them less virtuous. That wouldn't make sense, right? Because how can a person be thought of as less virtuous by virtue of factors over which they have no control at all? That's not reasonable. So take two people, one person who's been raised in a good home with a good family, who's able to exercise moderation, and another person who's been raised in a poor home with an abusive family who shows less of an ability to exercise moderation. Plain virtue ethics says the first person is more virtuous. But understanding that the various capacities that a person has are impacted by all of these relationships around them, that tells us that, no, if this person is being as moderate as they can be under the circumstances, then they are as virtuous as the first person. And if you think that that's not intuitively right, let's relate it to generosity as a virtue, right? And we can measure generosity in terms of dollars donated. I know it's not the best measure, but it'll do for our purposes. So all other things being equal, a person is more generous if they donate more dollars. So now we have Bill Gates, who has donated, I don't know, $30 billion. And we have me, who has donated, shall we say, considerably less. Is Bill Gates more generous than me? Well, all kinds of things factor into my inability to donate $1 billion or $30 billion, the least of which being I don't have $30 billion. And there were social and economic and other reasons for that. So is it right to say that Bill Gates is more virtuous than me because he donates more money and thus is more generous? Well, no. That doesn't make sense at all. We wouldn't say that he's, you know, more virtuous than me on that account. We could do, you know, a percentage calculation. Bill Gates donated half of his wealth. Well, I can't donate half of my wealth either. Because, again, if I donate half of my wealth, I'm going to be in deep financial trouble. You know, maybe not destitute. So, I mean, when we do percentages, it becomes now actually conceivable that I could do it. But still, there's a difference between the virtue of Bill Gates donating half of his wealth and me donating half of my wealth. So, you know, it all comes back to what I said in an earlier slide, right? All of the complexities make it pretty much impossible to talk in general terms about the virtue of a person, even with respect to their caring capacities. So we make the observation that people have various capacities for caring, but that variability does not translate directly or possibly in any way on their ethical capacity to care, or the ethical value of their caring. If we want to talk about ethics, is something that can be measured, which we probably don't. Still, we can identify the virtuous dispositions, and Toronto does that. And it's funny, you know, as I go through this and I say, well, you can't do it, but here's a place where they do it. Well, you can't do that, but here's a place where they do it. And that's a pretty common pattern. So we have four elements or sub-elements of care that can be thought of as virtues. We'll come back to the second part of the discussion in just a moment. Here are Toronto's four sub-elements. Attentiveness, or a proclivity to become aware of need, which is a bit hand-wavy. Responsibility, or a willingness to respond and take care of need. So we've got proclivity, we've got will. Competence, or the skill of providing good and successful care. And that goes back to the expertise, perhaps, or the knowledge that a teacher might have. And then finally, responsiveness, or consideration of the position of others. So proclivity, will, skill, and consideration. So, yeah, I mean, these are ways that we could talk about somebody being more or less caring or more or less able to care. But again, none of these should be thought of as absolute scales. We would take attentiveness, for example. A person with ADHD, an attentiveness disorder, has less of a capacity to show attentiveness than a person without that disorder. But that does not mean that a person without that disorder is ethically better than the person with the disorder. At least I would hope not, right? Because the person with the disorder is unable to do anything about it. And so, a lack in their capacity that results from the disorder is certainly not something that they're ethically responsible for. And so, it shouldn't be something we say is an ethical lapse on their part. To more or less a degree, we could say the same about all of the rest of these things, including even willingness. The will is one of these mythical characteristics of people, and there's a whole history of that. But different people have different will, if you will, than others, right? Or, maybe we can express it in terms of numbers, different degrees of willpower. Is a person with less willpower less ethical than a person with more willpower? Well, if it's something that they can't really change in themselves, why would it be an ethical responsibility? This is especially important when we consider some of the origins of the duty of care and the care ethic generally. We mentioned earlier about Gilligan responding to Kohlberg and about both of them being influenced by Piaget. And they talk about, well, Piaget talks about different stages of cognitive development. And so we draw the analogy, different stages of ethical development. And that shows up here, specifically in this discussion from Toronto, the different stages of ethical development, the virtuous dispositions, the different stages of these virtuous dispositions. So that a person perhaps moves from being less ethical to more ethical by building these capacities or these virtues in themselves. And that is kind of what you need in order to develop an ethic, but if their dispositions, if they're properties of the person that you are now, it's not clear that not having them is an ethical lapse. And I know it sounds like I'm talking in circles here, but you can't make people ethically responsible for things they can't change, I think. And that applies as much in care ethics as it does in any ethics, right? Ethics does seem to involve and require some kind of agency. And we focus a lot in the ethics of care on the agency of another person. But these relationships are two-way. And we have to also reflect on the agency of the person who was giving the care. And if you do the best you can under the circumstances with who you are and what you can do, that seems to be ethically as good as someone who is a natural caregiver. That doesn't mean we might not prefer the other person to give care. I'd rather be cared for by a person who's naturally good at it, but maybe exercising 60% of her capacities, than a person who's not very good at it doing the very best that they can. But that's not an ethical calculation anymore. That's something else. And I think that's an important point here. It does raise an aspect of care, the relationship aspect. Caring always happens in unequal relationships. No, I shouldn't say that. I don't think that's true. In many cases, caring involves unequal relationships. That's better. And a lot of these, like parenting and teaching, are transitory. They're not permanent. But the actual relationship of care actually does flow out of that unequalness. But unequal relationships are ethically problematic. And that's kind of an interesting thing here. The relationship with another person is, if it is unequal, then creating an ethics where you create an equality in that relationship is ethically difficult. And so we have the virtue of care as somebody as having actually more capacity than the other, treating the other person as equal to themselves. And that gets a bit hard to realize as an ethical stance. And the danger of this is that really you're creating as ethically valuable relationships where one person is the giver and the other person is the taker, where despite the giver being dominant, they're both being treated as equal, where the ethical value of the relationship is derived from one of these people being a dependent, which means you can't have ethics without dependence, and that seems wrong as well. I think that's the last slide I have on this. Let me just check. So that's where I'm going to end this particular discussion. But you can see it's hard, and I would argue pretty much impossible, to reinterpret the ethics of care as a virtue ethic. It's hard because of some of the inherent flaws in virtue ethics that don't take into account the specificity that the ethics of care takes into account. They treat these virtues as absolutes without respect to the particular circumstances either the carer or the recipient of care may find themselves in. And, we depict the relationship between the carer and the cared for as unequal, where there is this amassing of virtue on the part of the carer, but in fact, it's not necessarily going to be like that. And ideally, we want these relationships to be equal and two-way. But that means just as we have to look at the relationships of dependence on the care receiver, we also have to look at the relationships and dependence of the caregiver and allow for caregivers who aren't very good at giving care, nonetheless, through their efforts, still being virtuous, right? So it's not a property of the person that makes caring ethical. And I think that's pretty much the case. And so I'm going to treat with caution arguments about the degrees of care or the growth of an ethical person from being less ethical to more ethical through different stages of care. I think those are the impositions of externally objective frameworks that aren't really fair to the carer in question because, as the same writers pointed out, they might not be in a position to be able to exercise all the care that they could or should in a given circumstance. Okay, I'll leave that there. I know that was a bit convoluted, but the take home from that is the ethics of care isn't a virtue ethics or shouldn't be thought of one. It isn't about whether a person has care inside and that makes them more virtuous. And that's really important if we go back to the feminist roots of ethics of care. And it's not about, for example, women inherently being more virtuous because they have these capacities that other people don't have. It is not the fault of people who are not women that they don't have the capacities of women. And it doesn't make them less ethical. Every carer has different capacities, and the circumstances in which they find themselves and the relationships that they find themselves are factors beyond their control and arguably, and I would argue, not relevant to the ethics of their actions. All right, that's it for this section. We'll come up with duty and community in the next video. So I'm Stephen Downs. Bye for now.